From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
What America has to understand is that Central Intelligence, oh, actually not only Central Intelligence, all criminals in government, I'm an ex-federal agent, we're by no means anti-government. What we are anti are people who are in government, above the law, and really damaging America, doing horrendous damage.
Today, we're going to talk to Michael Levine, former DEA agent, and learn the real story of why we're losing the drug war, told by a man whose life is dedicated to winning it. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. More than 200 people have died in Indonesia over the past 4 days, either from fires or being fired upon, as thousands of students march through the streets continuing their calls for Suharto to step down. Armored troop carriers moved into Jakarta backed by some 15,000 Indonesian soldiers. Meanwhile, the dictator Suharto has returned from a state visit to Egypt, having cut that visit short. And the United States has canceled a military delegation to Indonesia, saying they wouldn't know who to meet with if they got there. This news from India. Following 5 nuclear tests that shocked the world, India's prime minister told supporters today he would use nuclear force if he had to. A.B. Vajpayee, speaking to a group of cheering farmers at his New Delhi residence, said the underground test explosions conducted this week established that India was capable of building a nuclear weapon. Meanwhile, Pakistan rejected appeals for restraint and told an international conference on disarmament that it needed a nuclear defense in the wake of rival India tests explosions this week. At the 61-nation meeting in Geneva, Delegate Munir Akram held open the possibility of Pakistani tests, which the New York Times said it had learned could take place as soon as Sunday. Guatemalan authorities have not cooperated with a commission investigating past human rights abuses, this according to a report released last night by Amnesty International. According to the group, the army covered up massacres, tortures, and disappearances during a counterinsurgency campaign throughout the 1980s. The organization dedicated its report to Roman Catholic Bishop Juan Herardi, who was beaten to death last month after releasing a report on the atrocities. Herardi exposed the army and allied paramilitary groups for being responsible for 80% of the abuses. An estimated 150,000 people died during the last few decades, and thousands more were tortured or kidnapped. Amnesty also said little progress has been made investigating the killing of Herardi, which the report called a crime that confirms a fact. Guatemala at present continues in the past. This news from the Middle East. Palestinians yesterday marked the 50th anniversary of the creation of Israel, an event they call the Nakba, or catastrophe, with 2 minutes of silence and several hours during which Israeli forces fired on crowds and 9 Palestinians were left dead. In the Gaza Strip, Israeli forces opened fire with live ammunition on Palestinians pressing in toward Jewish settlements, the Israelis said. They killed 8 Palestinians, 2 of them 8-year-old boys. One man was killed by a rubber-coated bullet in the West Bank town of Ramallah. Last night, as NBC was preparing to air its final episode of the situation comedy Seinfeld, the streets outside their New York City studios were filled with the sounds of protest. At issue, the previous week's episode of Seinfeld, in which one of the show's characters inadvertently burns a Puerto Rican flag and in response a mob of unruly Puerto Ricans wrecks his car. Also in that episode, 2 of the show's characters make what some feel are disparaging remarks about New York City's annual Puerto Rican Day parade and about Puerto Ricans in general. The Seinfeld episode has generated protest demonstrations in a number of cities across the country. A number of national Puerto Rican organizations have demanded a nationally broadcast apology. They also want to guarantee that the episode never be broadcast again, either by NBC or in syndication. This was the sentiment at a demonstration last night in New York City outside NBC studios.
Anything funny about stepping on Puerto Rican flag or burning the flag. I felt that it was quite a big offense to us and it should not be happening.
I was very angry. I think it was disgusting. Well, it's not a surprise. We live in a racist country, you know, and of course the media perpetuate all the stereotypes, you know. But that's what I am here, you know, to really stand up and tell to them that it's not a joke.
Both NBC and the show's producer, Castle Rock Productions, have said they did not mean to offend anyone. The general manager at WNBC-TV, the network affiliate in New York City, condemned the episode, but there has been no on-air apology and no promise that the episode will never be broadcast again. In fact, that is where The Seinfeld Show and Castle Rock will make their money. According to estimates, the syndication will bring Castle Rock $1.5 billion. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Over the course of the past year, the U.S. government has continued to increase military involvement in the so-called war on drugs. The Clinton administration is currently giving military aid to some of the most repressive governments in the Western Hemisphere, ostensibly for use in fighting the so-called war. Conditions on human rights are almost never imposed as a condition for anti-narcotic aid. A classic example of this is in Colombia, which is perhaps the worst violator of human rights in the Western Hemisphere. Despite its atrocious record on human rights, the administration allocated over $140 billion in military aid to Colombia. And numerous human rights groups have reported that military equipment and other U.S. assistance have been used to commit terrible human rights atrocities. And Colombia is not alone. Bolivia and Peru are among the other countries in the hemisphere that receive hefty military aid packages from the U.S. under the guise of the drug war, despite terrible human rights records. The so-called war on drugs has quickly replaced anti-communism as the U.S. government's justification for the backing of human rights-violating governments throughout the region. But the U.S. role does not end with assistance. Today, we're going to be speaking with Mike Levine, a former agent with the Drug Enforcement Administration for 17 years, worked with the government overall for a quarter of the century. He's going to talk about the role of the CIA and the DEA in this war on drugs. Mike Levine is the author of a number of books, including Deep Cover, The Big White Lie, and most recently, Triangle of Death. Michael Levine, why don't you start off by just explaining what you're going to talk about today?
On today's show, which is a special edition of my own show, The Expert Witness, we're going to discuss a book that was published back in 1990 that I wrote, actually wrote it in 1987 as it was happening, because I couldn't believe, 87 and 88, I couldn't believe what I was living through. And in essence, this book, which was a New York Times bestseller and voted by Bill Moyer as one of the 10 most censored by the media books in the country, it's a book that reveals, through the odyssey of a deep cover team, how America was lied to by their leaders in order to hide the fact that under the President Salinas de Gortari, who was about to be elected, America was about to trade NAFTA for a wide-open Mexico for drug trafficking. Now, at the time we wrote the book, we didn't realize it because we hadn't put it all together. But anyone who reads the book will see that this undercover team, which I headed, I was posing as Luis Miguel Garcia, half Sicilian, half Puerto Rican mafia don, and on video camera I bribed a grandson of the George Washington of Mexico, the grandson of Venustiano Carranza. He sat there right across from me in his a Mexican army uniform, colonel uniform, and we arranged for $1 million for the Mexican army to protect the first load of 1 ton of cocaine coming in from Bolivia into and help us smuggle it into California through Mexico.
This is true.
Oh yeah, it's all on video camera, and the whole case is actually on video. I mean, there's nothing anybody can deny. That's why on the Bill Moyer show you hear Bill Moyer say no one in the government would come on camera with Michael Levine. Well, there's nothing to discuss. They'd have to explain the videotapes and what happened. And it also, but the really sad part is that in Deep Cover, what we also found were definite links between a cover-up, at the very least, of the murder of Kiki Camarena, the torture murder of a DEA agent by Mexican officials. Now, Kiki Camarena happened to be investigating, among other people, a man who had a contract to fly goods down to the Contras, His name was Mata Ballesteros. The only trouble with this man getting a CIA/State Department contract, this of course was part of the CIA, Ali North, supply back and forth that is clearly drugs down to the U.S. and guns back. Mata Ballesteros was on DEA's file as one of the biggest drug dealers in this hemisphere. And again, as happened in many cases, like Manuel Noriega, because of expediency, Mata Ballesteros was protected. So were other people protected. And Mata Ballesteros was one of those who eventually was convicted of conspiring to murder this DEA agent. But Kiki was working on him, and nobody, you know, I think you can understand, I think basically a lot of mainstream media feels that if you tell these truths, we will destroy America's confidence in, CIA and confidence in our law enforcement. And, I think that sometimes to rebuild and make better, you have to destroy confidence. You can't reward that kind of performance by looking the other way. It only gets worse, and sure enough, it did. You know, we've seen it get much worse.
In your deep cover operation in Mexico, where you bribed the grandson of Mexico's George Washington, what, founding president?
Well, yeah, he, I think, was one of the authors of the Mexican Constitution, and they modeled it after the United States Constitution. And his grandson, Jaime Carranza, Colonel Jaime Carranza, was once written up as the 007 of Mexico in the U.S. magazines.
Now, what some might say is, well, you know, it's good that you did this, because here you're targeting a drug dealer in the military, and you can let Mexico know about it, and they'll take care of their drug dealers. This is actually stopping the flow of drugs into the United States. So what was the whole story, and why wasn't that the case?
Oh, well, great point. Well, the deal was supposed to be for 15 tons of cocaine. If our government had allowed us to follow the plan, which was known as Operation Trifecta, because we were right to the top of the drug world in Panama, Manuel Noriega's people, the money launderers, and we were right into La Corporación in Bolivia. And now these were the people who had been supplying the Contras right from the get-go, as we've discussed on my own show. And what happened was, mysteriously, our government refused to allow me to continue the investigation. They wanted me to make a buy bust instead of buying the drugs. And now, mind you, they wanted me to make a buy bust and bust everybody I had met, in spite of the fact that I had been promised that if the buy went through, now the buy would have cost the U.S. government $5 million. If the buy went through, I was going to be dealing with the top people in the Mexican government. And I was already dealing with a colonel and a mysterious general whom we hadn't met yet. And the colonel on camera said basically everyone in the general staff in the Mexican army was waiting to see how the deal went through and willing to work with us. And then he went further. They promised me, Luis Miguel Garcia, believing me to be the head of the mafia, they promised me that if the deal went through, and Salinas de Gortari, once he was elected, and that was 7 months away, and mind you, one of the people on camera was one of his bodyguards, Salinas de Gortari's bodyguards, once the deal went through, we were promised a wide-open Mexico for drug dealing. It would be much easier under Salinas de Gortari. Now, this was January of 1988. Now, mind you, this was not even 2 years. Well, Kiki Camarena was murdered on February 1985. So this was 1987. This is about 2.5 years after, well, maybe 85 to 88, about 3 years after Kiki's death. Hadn't even gone by. And the videotapes of these meetings went on an overnight jet to Washington, D.C., in the office of Edwin Meese. And all of a sudden, the case started to come apart. I was told Central Intelligence is in the case in five countries. I was astounded. I didn't know they were in the case, but immediately it started to make sense because of everything I had lived through in the Big White Lie, everything I had lived through in Bangkok, Thailand, and Southeast Asia. CIA is in it. Well, the drug case is gone.
Meaning they're going to bust it.
They're going to destroy it. You know, that meant we were at the top of the drug world, and they were in it in five countries, which means I was hitting CIA assets in Panama, I was hitting CIA assets in Bolivia, I was hitting CIA assets in Mexico. Now I figure that the other two countries were the Nicaraguans and the Hondurans who were involved in the case. Not only that, but on camera, this Mexican colonel, Carranza, points to a place in the Mexican map and says, this is where we're training the Contras. So our case was no longer a drug case, even though it was probably the biggest drug case in history, Deep Cover. And it was now something, I don't know, it was like a night. It turned into a nightmare. And that's when I started writing everything as it happened, using the actual tapes as it happened. And, you know, oddly enough, the book, a lot of people think it's Deep Cover, the movie that was made, but it's not. Although they used the plot points. In fact, they even called the perfect Operation Trifecta. But Deep Cover, this movie, the true story, my wife Laura Cavanaugh and I were actually hired by HBO for 2 years to write the screenplay for this, and mysteriously that ended. You know, they said that the man who wanted the project was gone. I don't know. You know, all of these things actually happen. You can't make it up.
Well, back to Mexico.
Oh, okay. So what happens in Mexico is we're ordered to end the case. Basically, and it makes no sense that we're ending the case, but no one gives any reason for this abrupt termination of the case.
And ending the case means busting the colonel.
Busting the colonel.
As you're giving him the $5 million.
Yes, exactly, which is what we did. And then,
how had they prepared for this delivery of drugs? Where were they going to receive it?
Well, the drugs were going to go. We had 15 tons, and members of my undercover team had gone down to Bolivia and seen the drugs. They saw something like 27 tons on the ground, ready to be shipped. Members of my undercover team went to Mexico and saw the Mexican army clearing a road in Puebla, Mexico, for our plane to land and getting ready to refuel our plane so that we can continue on into California with the first ton. Everyone was waiting for the first ton to go through to continue with the next 14 tons. There would have been 15 tons of cocaine, which would have been the beginning of an ongoing enterprise that was to continue right into Salinas's administration.
But wouldn't it have been a political problem for the United States if they allowed this first million to come into the United States, because it could be exposed they allowed drugs into the United States?
Well, that isn't the point. It would have been our drugs. The drugs never would have been distributed. We would have faked it, you know. It's not like CIA, you know. CIA just puts drugs on the streets and then says national security when they're caught. No, we were not going to allow the drugs to hit the street. We're professionals, you know, not amateurs. And but unfortunately, amateurs were running us. And the next thing that happened is, and this killed me, and it's in the book, and we verified it in 7 ways from Sunday. Edwin Meese, the Attorney General of the United States.
Under Reagan.
Under Reagan, telephoned the Attorney General of Mexico and told him about our case. We hadn't even made the arrests yet. Now, later, one of the bosses in customs in San Diego was quoted as saying, well, yeah, that's how easy it is. And what he left unsaid is to just kill a whole bunch of undercover agents. But we couldn't believe it. And when we made the arrests, as if to verify that they had been warned, the Mexican government was ready. They called Carranza an imposter. They were ready. They had been warned. And then we asked DEA in Mexico to shore up our investigation about who Carranza is, and they wouldn't do it. Now, the commander of the Mexican DEA office at the time was a man named Ed Heath, who had been accused during the Kiki Camarena murder of bottling up the cries, the alarm, the cries for help of the agents in Guadalajara, Mexico, so as not to, quote-unquote, disturb the ongoing special relationship between the U.S. and Mexico, which, in a nutshell, is they owed us a huge amount of money. They can do anything they want as long as they get paying us the money. Now, so we bust these people, Colonel Carranza, And Ed Heath stands up with the U.S. ambassador, Max Pilliot, who says, yes, this was a sting of a sting. These guys are phonies. They agree with Mexico. Trouble is, the first thing that Carranza says when he's arrested is he's got Ed Heath's personal phone number in his book. And he says, that's my friend. Therein begins a war that nobody ever heard about. And that's part of the story in Deep Cover.
We're talking to Michael Levine. Michael Levine, former DEA agent, agent of the Drug Enforcement Administration, and author of a number of books, including Deep Cover. We'll be back with him. We'll be back with him here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We were just listening to Mike Levine, former DEA agent, in 60 Seconds. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we resume our conversation with former DEA agent Mike Levine.
Through people in, well, other agencies, we learn, and I have the reports to back it up, that 6 months before Carranza's arrest, he had a dinner with Ed Heath and a general, a Mexican general, and this general's name was Chaparro. And that during this secret meeting, because this was a secret meeting, they discussed cooperation between the United States and Mexico in the drug war.
And Heath again from
Heath was
the U.S.
Well,
embassy.
Heath was. Heath was the chief DEA officer in Mexico at the time, and I couldn't believe this. But then it gets worse. We continue our investigation on our own, like a bunch of mavericks, and we link Chaparro in the same month.
The general. Mexico.
To Felix Gallardo meeting in that same month. Who's Felix Gallardo? Believed to be the mastermind on the death of Camarena.
Kiki Camarena,
Kiki
the
Camarena,
U.S. DEA
the U.S. agent. DEA
agent. Mike, hold it there because we have to break for stations to ID themselves. We're talking to Michael Levine, a man who knows the DEA from the inside. He was an agent within the Drug Enforcement Administration for 17 years, worked for the federal government in investigations overall for about a quarter of a century. He's author of the book Deep Cover, Inside, the inside story of how DEA infighting, incompetence, and subterfuge lost us the biggest battle of the drug war. He's also author of a novel, Triangle of Death. Unfortunately, the novel may be truer than most nonfiction books in this
country.
Triangle
of Death is a novel. It's a thriller, and it was intentionally made a thriller based on real facts. I think agencies, covert agencies like Central Intelligence, at least my wife and I, our experience is that they could care less about nonfiction. Nonfiction seems to not affect the majority of the American public as much as fiction does. You write a book like Deep Cover. This was a New York Times bestseller. And as Bill Moyer said, the entire U.S. government successfully ignored it. What happens? If Tom Clancy were to write a book, you know, showing the truth, you would see the government change. So we wrote Triangle of Death because we understand the Central Intelligence mentality. And what we used, among the many real facts we used, was the actual grisly torture of Kiki Camarena in Triangle of Death for our quote-unquote fictional character.
Let's talk again, because I think some people may remember the death of this DEA agent, Kiki Camarena, and you just said that you linked one of these top drug dealers in Mexico with the guy who was involved with the torture of Kiki Camarena. What exactly happened to him? What was he investigating in Mexico?
Well, Kiki Camarena had done a huge marijuana case. He had cost the Mexican drug mafia a lot of money, burned out a huge field, one of the biggest seizures of marijuana at the time. And he was working on Mata Ballesteros, an active investigation, who was himself actively working for the State Department and the then Iran-Contra resupply mission. And Kiki Camarena was suddenly arrested on February 9th, I think it was, 1985, in broad daylight, in front of the U.S. consul, and spirited away by killers, some of whom were using DFS. At the time, that was the equivalent of Mexican CIA credentials, and two Jalisco State policemen, I think there were five, who threw him into the back of a car, put a jacket over his head, broad daylight. And now, mind you, this was a reconstruction done by informers. There were all kinds of people. It was high noon in downtown Guadalajara, Mexico, and there was not one witness willing to talk. And the Mexican government actually did everything they could to block the investigation, to block it. Of course, as happened just recently, and as happened right after we wrote Deep Cover and had the trial, Mexico was granted cooperating nation in the drug war. I mean, how bizarre, how much phonier can you get? Only in this last instance where Janet Reno and the Clinton administration called them cooperating, the head of DEA this time, Tom Constantine, called it phony, you know, but they did it anyway. So what do you do, you know? What do you do but keep telling the truth that the mainstream media just simply doesn't tell? You know, instead of journalists from reputable organizations trying to explain, you know, what are we talking about? We're talking about a $50 billion a year drug war. We're talking about $50 billion that are spent by a nation who the children who are deserving can't go to college. Hardworking people cannot get health insurance. Social Security system is collapsed, and we're spending $50 billion a year, $19 billion federally, and when you start adding up the states, that's $50 billion a year. And now here you have the head of the Drug Enforcement Administration saying that the Clinton administration is phony, and they're talking about the biggest gateway for drugs on earth into the U.S. is Mexico, a 2,000-mile border. So wouldn't you think that that's a Pulitzer Prize winning story, I think, rather than, you know, some of the amazing reportage that I see. Go ahead.
Well, there was one guy who did try to do some reporting on this, Gary Webb, and we had him on the show a few days ago. Mike, you know Gary Webb, and you know that he has a new book out as well, but he is no longer a journalist. He is in the California legislature now being a researcher. He was pushed out of the San Jose Mercury News.
Yeah, I predicted that on these airwaves, actually, when it first came. I think Samori Marksman asked me, what do you think is going to happen? I said, he's finished. And he was still working for San Jose. I said, it'll be a matter of time. He's out of journalism. And sure enough, he was. What did he do other than tell the truth?
Well, one of the things he talked about was, the main point of what he talked about was how U.S.-supported Contras brought drugs into this country to fund the Contra operation, which Congress had voted could not be supported by the U.S. government, and they sold drugs, particularly in the black community of Los Angeles. One of the cases he investigated was the Frogman case, and very recently, the CIA Inspector General did an investigation of the CIA. They said they were going to put out two parts of a report, but they haven't put out the second part. They've only put out the first. And he also said he looked into the Frogman case. Do you actually have the cassette of hits today?
I actually do. As
you
a matter
do?
Of fact, yeah.
Why don't we play a little of it, of hits talking about his investigation of this case, but maybe first you could give us the context for that case.
Well, what America has to understand is that Central Intelligence, not only Central Intelligence, all criminals in government, you know, BAI, myself, and I'm an ex-federal agent, we're by no means anti-government. What we are anti are people who are in government, above the law, and really damaging America, doing horrendous damage to America. And Hitz, his statement reveals really a massive ineptitude. It's what's really surprising. And then, you know, I'm someone who put thousands of Americans in jail for conspiracy. You know, again, of course, mainstream media will beat you to death with the term conspiracy theorist. Well, They've done such a good job in brainwashing the American public about that phrase that when I say, look, it's easier to put someone in jail for conspiracy than the substantive crime, people have been put in jail for just nodding. You know, if you have experts get on the stand and say, well, that nod was approval of a deal, you know, they're gone. So now you have hits coming on national television, C-SPAN, and all us seven watchers, you know, that's what they count on, all of us seven people who watch the thing, and I'm taping this because I can't believe what
all
I'm
you
seeing.
Former DEA agents out of jobs.
Yeah, exactly, you know, so so all of us seven were outraged, you know, and because we all immediately called each other and said, do you believe what this guy is saying?
Well, let's take a listen.
Well, you know, the important thing is that Hitz, before he made his statement, summarized the CIA's report saying, we found ourselves innocent. And that's all mainstream media put out. Absolutely nobody from the New York Times to the Washington Post must have read that report, because if you have any knowledge whatsoever of conspiracy investigations, you see the report itself is a blanket admission of conspiracy to traffic in drugs to the U.S.
Right, actually revealed a lot.
Oh, yeah. And then his statement even goes further. I mean, his statement, that, you know, also before we play the tape, he promised that volume two was due by the end of last month. And of course, it never got there. Well, the uproar, and I think WBAI and Democracy Now, we helped create that incredible uproar, it scared them. You know, they said, well, maybe we better not put out volume two. If volume one was so bad, really terrible, you know. What's dismaying is that these are the people who are supposedly the covert operators. They're sharp as a tack, you know. And the ineptitude and really amateurishness revealed by Hitz in his statement is beyond belief to me. You know, this is a $30 billion a year agency, Central Intelligence. Just beyond belief.
What do you think were the biggest admissions of guilt by the Inspector General's own report on the CIA?
Well, two that I take. One was really wild. You know, he said that the policy on drug information, he called it a movable feast prior to, I wonder what he meant by that. A movable feast is what his words, prior to 1982. Well, which was not true, because I was stationed in Argentina between 78 and 82, and under the Carter administration, CIA was mandated to get active in the drug war, aid the Drug Enforcement Administration, and as I wrote in The Big White Lie, I couldn't even get a camera from them. So, you know, that was complete untruth, okay, to be polite. In 1982, he said there was a secret agreement between, hammered out, he said, between Central Intelligence and the Justice Department, so that lasted from 82 to 95, where CIA did not have to tell the Justice Department about drug dealing assets as long as they weren't CIA employees. Now, in other words, that was a license, the constitutionality of which I question, and we're going to have people on my show to talk about whether that was even constitutional, a secret agreement for Central Intelligence to commit a felony. That is, aiding and abetting by looking the other way. Now, I put two New York City policemen in jail for exactly that, 10 and 12 years in prison. One of them committed suicide. They had a friend who was selling ounces of cocaine, and they just didn't do their job. They didn't make money. They didn't help them. They looked the other way. They went to jail. So that, you know, for any of you media people listening, is conspiracy. That's not conspiracy theory. I was trained by four federal agencies. As a matter of fact, among the agencies whose training I underwent was Central Intelligence, intelligence gathering. And so the bottom line is, so Hitz talks, he talks about CIA asset Enrique Bermudez giving money to
a Contra leader.
The Contra leader, but he was like the number one asset, but not an employee. Do you understand? Under U.S. law, if you're an asset, you represent the U.S. government legally. No, and let me tell you something. I've been there many, many times in court. You legally represent the U.S. government, and Enrique Bermudez represented the U.S. government. Well, he gave money to two known drug dealers to go where? To Bolivia, in 1982, to do a drug deal. Now, at the same time, if you read The Big White Lie, Central Intelligence was actively protecting the Bolivian government drug dealers. They were running the Bolivian government, and I documented in The Big White Lie that There were two meetings held, with one with Pat Sullivan, the U.S. Attorney in Miami, CIA representatives, DEA representatives, where they blocked us going forward with an indictment. And this was 1982 when they signed the agreement. Now, what I'm describing here is evidence of conspiracy to traffic drugs to our people, to our country. In the words of Al D'Amato, we tax Americans billions to fight drugs, and we're in bed with them, and this is the living proof. Now, here we had Hitz admitting it. Then you had Hitz saying, well, a CIA attorney tried to get drug money back in the Frogman case. Unfortunately, Hitz tells us, he doesn't remember. He doesn't remember why he did it.
Who was the Frogman?
Well, the Frogman was the Zavala case. It was something like 500 kilos. I forget the exact amount. Kilos of cocaine seized in California. And
it was called the Frogman because...
It was called the Frogman case because they were swimming the stuff in Frogman outfits, you know. And I've seen cases like that right here in New York.
And so they were picked up by DEA?
They were picked up by DEA and Customs.
And how much money did they have?
And I forget the exact amount
of
money.
But they seized it.
They seized the money. They seized the drugs. It was a huge case. And, of course, some of the money belonged to the Contras. A CIA attorney wrote a letter to the United States attorney asking for that money back. I think it was $36,000. But the amount doesn't, it shows what they're doing. The amount is really insignificant. That's enough for conspiracy to send you away for life if you're an ordinary American. But you know, the fact that the CIA attorney just wrote a letter to the U.S. attorney and said, give us the money back, it's CIA money, you know, like, who cares whether it's drug money?
Wait, so the CIA said, give us our money back.
Yeah, give us our money back. Now, in Hitz's investigation, he determined, after speaking to the U.S. attorney, that they were going to give the money back anyway. But he doesn't answer the question, well, why did the CIA send it in the first place?
Now, did they give the money back to the guy who was caught?
Yes, they did. Eventually, they gave the money back, drug money, back to the guy who was caught. And Hitz, in his investigation that he says, looked under every rock and left no stone unturned, was satisfied with the fact that the CIA attorney couldn't remember why he did it.
Let's take a listen to Hitz describing how it is the CIA told the U.S. attorney in California that you've got to give the money back that you seized from this drug dealer who was caught swimming in with drugs and money.
Yeah, basically. That's the story. I mean, can you imagine John Gotti saying, you know, I didn't remember?
Well, that's awesome.
To attend depositions in Costa Rica from two members of Contra organizations who had provided Zavala with letters that claimed that some $36,000 that the authorities had seized from Zavala at the time of his arrest belonged to the Contras. CIA officials mistakenly identified one of the Contra members as a former CIA asset.
Mistakenly.
And there
was
a concern
a jury
that the
of American
might
suffering,
expose a Contra support group in which CIA had an operational interest.
Might have.
No information was found to indicate that the two Contra officials who wrote the letters supporting Zavala or the organizations with which they were affiliated were involved in drug trafficking. Moreover, the principal author of the letters reportedly was later expelled from the Contra group when its leadership learned he had written the letter in support of Zavala's claim, and he could not satisfactorily explain the basis for his actions.
They made him go through the mill,
in
for
any event,
dealing drugs.
An attorney from the CIA's Office of General Counsel met with the responsible prosecutor and possibly other representatives from the U.S. Attorney's Office. Prior to the CIA attorney's meeting with the prosecutor had discussed with one of Zavala's attorneys the possibility of returning the money.
That's right, the possibility of returning the money. Well, we have to break it there. I want to thank Michael Levine for joining us, former DEA agent for 17 years, worked with the Drug Enforcement Administration, author of the books Deep Cover, as well as Triangle of Death. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. More than 200 people have been killed in Indonesia over the past 4 days, either from fires or from being fired upon, as thousands of students marched through the streets, continuing their calls for Suharto to step down. Armored troop carriers have moved into Jakarta, backed by some 15,000 Indonesian soldiers. Today, we'll continue our series, hearing the voices of young Indonesian activists. We hear from Aryati. It's not her real name. She's an Indonesian activist who disguised her identity so that her family in Indonesia will not face repercussions for her testimony, the testimony she gave last Thursday before the U.S. Congress. Aryati.
I come to speak to you here today with some trepidation. Indonesia is not a free country where one can express criticism of the government without worry about the possible consequences upon one's safety. I have no guarantees of protection. I'm not a prominent leader of a mass organization, nor a member of the elite who has high connections. I'm an Indonesian from a middle-class background who is scared about telling you my honest opinions. I take this risk because I feel compelled to. I'm one of the youth of my country who will have to bear, for many years into the future, the burden of what mistakes and crimes the government is committing today. I take this risk also in the hope that the U.S. government, so long a staunch and powerful supporter of Suharto's militarism, will reform itself and do something to ensure that Indonesia does have a government that respects and guarantees basic civil liberties, such as the freedom of speech, the freedom of the press, and the freedom of association. Mr. Chairman, first I would like to present some facts about the military in Indonesia. To understand the Suharto government, you have to understand the Indonesian military, for we have been living under what is an institutionalized martial law regime for the past 33 years. It is no ordinary military. It has what is officially called a dual function: external defense and internal policing. Imagine for a moment that the U.S. military had overthrown the U.S. government by staging a coup and orchestrating the slaughter of about 500,000 people. Imagine the military then set up headquarters in each state, each county, each city, and each town. Imagine that it placed one-third to one-half of the U.S. military's troops in these headquarters. Imagine that there were no laws governing their actions, nor any legislative oversight. Imagine further that the civilian administration was constantly monitored and controlled by the military, and that many of the civilian administrators were themselves military officers. If you can imagine this scenario, then you have a pretty good idea of how the Indonesian military operates. It is omnipresent, all-pervasive, and beyond the law. When the U.S. military speaks about training Indonesian military officers to respect human rights, we can only laugh. The structure of the Indonesian military places it as an all-powerful institution, and the laws of our country allow it complete freedom to do what it wills. A few courses in good behavior are not going to alter what it is, a very oppressive system of military rule. Besides, we are not even certain that the U.S. military is sincere in claiming that it is providing such training. The U.S. Congress should feel no qualms about cutting off JSAT training if it is thinking about our benefit. Once the JSAT training became public knowledge, the Pentagon claimed that it was meant only for the benefit of U.S. soldiers who were given the opportunity to see how another military operates. So, by the Pentagon's own admission, the training was not designed to help the Indonesian military acquire less brutish habits. Mr. Chairman, let me explain how the government instills in us a culture of fear and robs us of our basic civil rights. In response to the student protests sweeping the country, the government has decided to intimidate the students by resorting to the tactic of disappearances. According to the leading legal aid organization in Indonesia, ELBHI, there are 50 persons that have disappeared over the past 3 months. One Shunaf activist present here, another one who disappeared is Andi Arif. Military personnel kidnapped him from his home in full view of his family on March 28. The top generals of our country not only denied that the military had kidnapped him, they joked to the press that he had simply disappeared of his own accord. For 3 weeks, his family, his friends, and his fellow students worried themselves to the point of exhaustion. Knowing how the military operates, they were concerned for his very survival. On April 22nd, he turned up in the Jakarta Central Police Station. The police had no arrest warrant and no explanation for how he got there. And the Arif told his lawyers that he had been kidnapped by the special forces Kopassus, held for 3 weeks of interrogation, and then dumped at the police station. One must note that the military did not break the law by kidnapping these 50 activists because none of the laws of our country apply to the military. Thus, Andy Arif's parents cannot sue Kopassus for arresting their son without a warrant and holding him in detention without habeas corpus. This is precisely what makes ordinary citizens so terrified of the military. It is unpredictable and unaccountable. It has been said that one can judge a government by its prisons. Well, then, let us look at Indonesian prisons. There we will find people whose only crime was to criticize the government. Sri Bintang Pamungkas, the leader of an independent political party and an ex-member of the parliament, criticized the government. He is now in Cipinang prison in Jakarta on charges of subversion. Accompanying him in that prison are 12 members of the banned People's Democratic Party convicted of thought crimes. In the language of the prosecutors, they deviated from the state ideology. There are presently at least 25 political prisoners in Indonesian prisons. Some are in their teens, some in their 70s. Just in the past 3 months, 250 people have been arrested on political crimes, such heinous crimes as holding peaceful meetings and holding peaceful demonstrations. We have a government that has a pathological fear of any public assembly that it does not control, and any public leader who does not grovel before our president. Every single independent political party and trade union has been systematically destroyed by the government. In regions of the country where there has been serious organized resistance to the government, such as Irian Jaya, West Papua, and occupied East Timor, it has not has been satisfied with arrest. It has resorted to massacres. You can guess what type of society we have. We are people who are terrified of expressing our own opinions and terrified of getting involved in politics of any kind. Politics for us is a spectator sport, and a cruel sport it is. We are daily bombarded by the statements of officials who are barely literate, barely articulate, and barely educated. When faced with public criticism, they speak of crushing, smashing, and hacking. They treat the youth of our country, those in their teens and 20s, who are sincerely and peacefully attempting to change the society, as though they were foreign agents bent on subversion. We are not citizens of a state. We are subjects of a modern militarized sultanate. It is obvious today that Suharto's reign is coming to a miserable end. The number of public demonstrations, public protests has been escalating. There has been growing support for the East Timor independence. In fact, some East Timorese students has been leading some of the demonstrations and has worked together with Indonesian students. Yet, this is a necessary condition for democracy in Indonesia. That is the ending of Suharto's presidency. But it is not a sufficient condition. The military, with its dual function, is prepared to continue Suhartoism without Suharto. What I mean is that the sources of the systematic human rights abuses we see today are not going to vanish with the demise of the Suharto presidency. For genuine democracy to exist in Indonesia, our laws will have to be changed to embody basic principles of human rights, and the military will have to be confined to the barracks and put under civilian oversight. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to give some explanation about the economic condition for the past 3 months and the impact of the IMF bailout on the people at large. For the past 33 years, we have been told the system of martial law was necessary for our material benefit. The religion of the government, its legitimating ideology, has been economic development, what is called in Indonesian pembangunan, or development. But what we have to show for 30 years of development. 200 families have fed Swiss bank accounts while millions of people have had their land expropriated. A few timber contractors and palm oil companies have accumulated fortunes while chopping and burning down most of the rainforest. 30 years of development has meant the victimization of many Indonesians. and we have not heard all their laments precisely because there has been no freedom to criticize what the state calls, its development program. 30 plus years of development under martial law has meant the accumulation of an enormous debt. For 30 years, the United States, Japan, and Europe provided billions of dollars annually as foreign aid to the Suharto regime. The US government, since Suharto took power in 1965 by ordering the massacre of thousands of people, has consistently maintained that his regime provides stability and security. Every single US president since Nixon, including the present incumbent, has to their shame celebrated the Suharto regime for its economic accomplishments and political stability. In effect, the US government has said that the Indonesian people were best kept under the thumb of a sultanate and that democracy was opposed to our best interest. US academics and retired foreign service personnel, such as those at the US Indonesia Society here in Washington, DC, have been saying that Indonesians would just have to sacrifice their political freedoms for economic growth. The economic crisis of the past nine months has put bait to these cynical propositions. Now, after suffering so that development could proceed, what is the prospect of the Indonesian people under the IMF bailout? In short, we are now expected to suffer even more to pay off a debt that we did not incur. Thanks to the Suharto regime's deal with the IMF, all Indonesians have been put into debt bondage. Our labor and resources are supposed to be devoted to paying off the debt for the next generation. Meanwhile, those 200 families who contracted the debt have enough money in their own personal accounts to pay it off many times over. Is it possible to deny that this current economic austerity plan by the IMF is a gross injustice? The Indonesian people never approved of accepting all those loans. We weren't even allowed to know what the government's economic policy was for all those years. Not even our farcical showcase parliament was given authority over economic policy, nor is it given any authority now. But the IMF is telling us that we have to share the debt burden equally. While it is apparently acceptable to the IMF that political power is monopolized, it absolutely insists that the debt be democratically distributed. Those governments that have loaned money to the Suharto regime and its crony capitalists for the past 30 years are now supporting the IMF's agreement. Thus, they appear to us like heroin pushers who, after keeping an addict hooked for years and driving him even deeper in debt, throw him back on his family when he is near collapse, telling them that they have to foot the bill for his rehabilitation and for all his past debts. Mr. Chairman, please do not believe that you are doing us any favors by authorizing money for the IMF loans to Indonesia. We need democracy in order to settle our economic problems, but that is not a word you will find in the agreement between Suharto and the IMF. The IMF, with the blessing of the Clinton administration, is actually hoping to engineer an economic recovery under the same political conditions of institutionalized martial law. This is, I assure you, an impossible dream. The protests against the Suharto regime have by now reached the point of no return. The Indonesian people, now that they have had the opportunity to express their long-suppressed grievances against the regime, are not going to be satisfied until it falls. Democracy is a rare commodity these days, but it is no less vital to us than rice. It is paradoxical that the IMF is willing to dictate terms to Suharto when it comes to managing the economy, but not when it comes to fundamental economic rights, such as the right of workers to organize. The IMF refuses to insist that, as a condition for receiving the loans, the government recognize workers' rights. It calls that meddling in the internal affairs of Indonesia when it already controls the government's economic policy. If the IMF's agreement meddled in such a way as to allow the Indonesian people to have a greater voice over economic policy, then perhaps the US Congress should support it. But as it stands, the agreement is a worthless piece of paper signed by a collapsing dictator. The IMF money is not going to benefit us. As you know, much of the money will be simply transferred to foreign banks that made risky loans to the Indonesian government and Indonesian enterprises. The money will enter Indonesia for a moment and then get sent back out as debt payments. These payments are supposed to restore investor confidence. But one has to wonder what kind of investors these are who believe in being rewarded for making bad decisions. It is astonishing that the foreign banks that made risky loans to a corrupt and unstable economic system want to be repaid in full. It is even more astonishing that they want the Indonesian people to pay for their bad decisions. Look at the tragic conditions Indonesia is now in after 30 years of US-supported stability and development. Indonesia has an abundance of fertile land, yet we are now begging other countries to give us supplies of our staple food, rice. The Food and Agriculture Organization estimates that Indonesia needs to be given 2 million tons of rice for the estimated 7.5 million Indonesians who will require food assistance within the next year. There is a famine in eastern Indonesia and East Timor now. We, living in other parts of the country, hardly hear anything about it, and what we do hear are government whitewashes. We have been told by the Suharto regime and the US government to exchange our political freedoms for economic prosperity. We have wound up with neither. As the last part, I'd like to propose some recommendations for the US Congress. As US Congressman, you must realize that the only force that the military appears to feel accountable to is the US government. You greatly determine whether the Indonesian government receives economic aid from the IMF and political legitimacy in international forums such as the United Nations. I can assure you that the Suharto regime, feeling entirely unaccountable to the Indonesian people, does feel beholden to the US government. It panics on seeing any sign of displeasure with it here in Washington, D.C. I urge you to listen to more people than just Indonesian government officials and retired State Department officials. Since the government has not allowed for any opposition political leaders or parties to exist, it may seem difficult to know to whom one should listen. I suggest that you listen to those who have had the determination to sacrifice for their beliefs and the bravery to risk military violence to assert what they believe to be the truth. You should listen to people such as Sri Bintang Pamungkas, who has demanded that the international community refrain from loaning money and giving military aid to Indonesia until a democratic regime can be established. You should especially listen to the youth, such as Yusuf Sri Lanang, who have no interests other than those of the nations. In conclusion, I would recommend that the US military not assist the Indonesian military. The US government should restrict itself to civilian relations with the Suharto regime. The US Congress should not authorize money for the IMF to be loaned to the Suharto regime. Thank you.
Aryati is an Indonesian activist using a different name so that her family in Indonesia won't face repercussions for her testimony before the U.S. Congress last week. That does it for today's show. If you'd like a copy, you can call the archives at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Jeremy Scahill. Errol Maitland's our technical director. Julie Drizin, our executive producer. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!